you know, it is, no one's going to like this out there who's listening. It's season four. Season three ended in part 17, and season four was part 18. Sorry, everyone. We're not getting anything else. So. They've already given us season four. There it was. One episode.
Dorky shoes. All you had to do is click your heels, and you would have seen it. I love that. That's great. Yeah, it's so important. And then as I kind of look back to, I mean, we're not even out of part 18 yet. Look how many portals we've already talked about. There's the curtain close. Oh, I guess we need to talk about the energy source, like when they drive up to those power lines. That seems to be a barrier too.
Right. So, I mean, if you want to keep moving backward, we can. If you want to just encapsulate the first 15 minutes, you know, again, part 18 is thresholds. I mean, part 18 is border crossings. So, yes, there was the one with Diane and Cooper, and then Diana's left. Before that, though, there was the border crossing, literally described as a crossing by Diane. You know, once we cross, it will all be different. I mean, Cooper is going to cross, and he's already crossed to that point. And yes, so they get to that point in the desert, 430 miles somehow. Cooper knows it's miles. It was never, you know, explicitly told to him, at least we didn't hear that. And then he moves the car across that particular point in space and time, and then suddenly they're shooting through the night in a whole different world. So they've crossed over there. There's arguably a crossing that we don't see, and that's them getting in the car, you know, leaving Glastonbury Grove where they met. You know, we just transitioned to them in the car. And so if you don't mind me just kind of quickly going into the parts that came before, you know, what is conceivably one of the most important border crossings in the entire story is Cooper finally parting those curtains and stepping out of the Red Room, and leaving this, we can call it a mental state, a fugue, a stasis that he's been trapped in for 25 years. There's lots of different ways to describe whatever Cooper was in. We can say it was metaphoric, and that he finally, like Audrey, kind of woke up from his coma or his delusion, or he literally was in another supernatural space that he couldn't get out of. And then finally he does. He is able to step out from those curtains. And recall, there was a moment in part two where Cooper tried to do that and he was blocked. Arguably that is maybe the first threshold that blocked him. But he tried to push through the curtains, and he's kind of pushed back by an electric force, or I forget what the sound effect is described as, but he can't get out. And he can't get out because he wasn't ready to get out. He had to be rehabilitated. Things had to happen, either psychologically or literally in the physical world. There had to be the defeat of certain evil forces and a return of an evil half to the realm, and the reemergence of Cooper. We can talk about that literally. We can talk about that metaphorically. Both of them work equally well. They both have to. They have to happen for him to pass through that border. And so, you know, at a certain point, he is ready. He has been rehabilitated enough to pass through that very important border. And of course, the only person who's there is Diane. Nobody else is there. There's no Harry Truman there. There's no Gordon Cole there. There's no Hawk there. And Hawk was seeking perhaps that point in part two. Only Diane is there. And so, yeah, so that's significant too, that she represents an important part of who he is. And he reunites with her so they can continue to cross borders. And arguably, we did talk about this in Diane, and arguably the fact that she only crosses so far and then stops may be part of Cooper's handicap going forward. He needs Diane, and she's not there with
that. You know, we talked about baggage in our very first episode. If we think about the baggage that Cooper carries outside of those Red Room curtains when he parts the curtains, was his time in the Red Room a time of torture? Was it a time of duress? Just danger? What do you think he's walking out of there with?
I think that's a really good question, you know, because the thing about the Red Room, and again, we have to remember to think of it metaphorically as well as literally, is that, you know, arguably no time has passed. I mean, Lynch actually directs McLaughlin at one point, you know, by saying no time has passed for you. So you could say that, you know, when Cooper steps out of those curtains, you know, it's only been for him maybe a number of hours since he stepped in and left Harry Truman in the woods. It could be an eternity of sorts that Cooper's been in there. And I do think it is he's experiencing a great deal of anxiety when he's in the Red Room. And I think it speaks to who Cooper is, perhaps the Cooper we are now seeing in part 18. We have a more objective view of Cooper, that in the Red Room, he was, I don't say reliving, but just stewing in the regrets of his life, the decisions he made that may have gone wrong, the things he wishes he could have done differently, the actions he took that maybe hurt someone else. All of it is left open for us to interpret and read into what we want. But the idea is that Cooper is a stressed individual, and this time in the Red Room was a time for him to dwell in that anxiety. And when he comes out, he's ready to try to put things right.
What can you do to put it right? I feel like this is the torture that McNulty goes through in The Wire. You know, you deal with someone that has been murdered under a crime so terrible as that. Merely finding out the mechanics and logistics of how they were killed never does away with the trauma. And so where does that trauma go? Well, the detective will take it on themselves in different ways, I guess. You know, it's not something that can be solved. You can't go back and undo time.
Well, yes, that's exactly it. I think Cooper has yet to learn that lesson that, he can't erase it. He can't change it. He has to live with it. So he has to come to terms with it. And does he come to terms with whatever is haunting him? Or is he still hoping that he can just somehow either expunge it or find a way to forget it, which I guess is the same way in some ways as expunging, although expunging could be in his mind a literal way of saying it never happened.
Right. Well, I think that's what happens, don't you think? Like, think of the final line. You know, what year is it? I feel like it's all wrapped up in that.
Yeah, I think you know, this is getting a little off topic, but it fits. You know, I think Cooper in part 18 is just not able to see the bigger picture. I mean, he's narrowed in on the mission, and, you know, and this is true and somewhat in part 17. I mean, we are seeing Cooper from an objective point, maybe in our 18, but, you know, Cooper behaves, you know, especially at the end of part 17. I was just writing about this, you know, when Cooper takes Laura's hand in the woods. And it's important to talk about 17 here because it's repeated in 18. He goes to get Laura and he says to her, "I'm taking you home," and he walks her into the woods. And I, you know, what does he think is going to happen? What is, you know, he doesn't. I don't think he knows. I don't think he has thought that far ahead. I think for him, it's simplistic. It's you know, reduced to this. I've just got to get you home. I've just got to keep you alive. Well. Do you really want to do that? I mean, do you want to bring her home? Doesn't he know that home was a terrible place for Laura? That it was a torturous place for her? Or does he think that he has fixed that as well? I don't know. I don't think Cooper knows. He says, "I'm taking you home." I can't help but ask the question. And then what? And then what, Cooper? What will you accomplish by bringing Laura home? I don't think for Cooper, again, it's not, he's not really thinking about Laura. He's thinking about himself. If I bring you home, you didn't die or I didn't make a mistake. He can't get outside of himself. And so, that is why at the end of part 18, he's still kind of like, what? I don't understand what's happening because, he's just not able to get there.
Yeah, I think, and I don't think it's off topic at all. I think, you know, Cooper's psychological profile as he moves through these barriers is very much, you know, what we're talking about here. And it's the same person that, you know, earlier on thought that throwing rocks at bottles was going to solve a mystery. You know, if a detective really did that to a murder victim, just imagine, you know, how a family would respond if, you know, God forbid one of us had to deal with a situation like that. And this cavalier detective comes rolling in and starts throwing rocks at bottles, talking about how he's going to solve this mystery of who killed your child. I mean, it's ridiculous and full of hubris on its surface. But we love Cooper, so we give him a pass on it. But I think now we're winding down to the point where we're shedding all of that. And there is a descent and a loss of hubris, I think, in, especially in 17 and 18, as we move through these portals.
Yeah, and this is a threshold of a different sort. This is a threshold that Lynch is putting on us, the viewer, because he has he's done something very subversive here, I would argue, is that, you know, that rock throwing thing that you talk about and the Cooper that we know from the original series and the Cooper we see through Cooper's eyes in the first 17 parts is this eccentric, extremely alluring character. We love Dale Cooper. We love the Dale Cooper Cooper wants us to see. He is super heroic in many respects. He is, he is curious. He is lively. He is engaging, and we have lived with that character for decades, and we fell in love with that character in the original series. And at a certain point, Lynch is asking us, the viewer, to disassociate ourselves, to see Cooper in a different way, to cross a threshold, and see now it was Cooper through the first 17 parts, but the Cooper in part 18. Is really the way Cooper is. He's not humorous. He's not curious. He doesn't care that much. It seems like he does, but he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's just programmed to do something. And so this subversion here is, and I think why many people may be unhappy with Twin Peaks is Lynch is saying the Cooper you thought you knew is the Cooper that he wanted you to see. He's not really like that. And so how are you going to process? How are you going to cross that threshold now? Are you going to take some lesson from that and say, oh, okay, wait a minute, the way I see myself isn't necessarily the way other people see me, and are there lessons I can learn from that? And can I, you know, change the way I behave? Is he a story that we should take some lessons from? And so I think that's tough to make that crossing. And I think, like Diane, some of us don't make that crossing with him. We just don't do it. And so we're upset with what we see happen to Cooper.
Feel left behind.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the same experience that a lot of people had when The Last Temptation of Christ was released, both as the novel and as the film, certainly by Martin Scorsese in the 80s. I feel like that idea of deconstructing a character that had been so put on a pedestal for so long into a human with flaws, very laudable flaws, and who made a choice that was a very human choice, or that was not a human choice, I should say, is a very similar situation to what you just described.
That's an interesting comparison. I mean, not to get too far into comparing Cooper as a Christ figure, but I think Cooper sees himself sometimes as a savior, that he is the one who will save everyone. He sees himself that way. In the Buddhist teachings, I mean, if you are a bodhisattva, then you truly are someone who has given up all of your worldly interests to benefit humanity. I guess Cooper sees himself as that, but he is not that.
But he is not, right? It's the difference. It's the delta between the reality. But I feel like we get closer to that at the end, because he has shed all of his attachments pretty much except for the mission by the end. And the mission is ripped away from him, and he's just left there with all of that compassion in the street.
I'd have to think about that. I leave Cooper as, you know, he was a cog in the machine, in the larger machine, and he never understood what the bigger machine was doing. You know, he was spinning, you know, he's a he's a cog and he's just spinning along, and he thinks he's the machine, but he's not. He's just this piece of it. And by the end, he's kind of like, wait a minute, what happened? The machine made something. I don't know what it made. I don't understand it. I can't see it. And so, you know, where am I? You know, what happened? And I think that's how I leave Cooper. But again, look, I want to certainly say that, you know, I come at it from a certain angle. And if you're seeing it differently with it, yeah, I mean, that is completely valid.
So, you know, most of us have a very good understanding that we cannot go back in time and change history. Why is it so hard for Cooper? Like, why do we have to go through 100 different portals and doors and thresholds to get to a realization that a child has?
Yeah, I guess I think because Cooper thinks he can. I think Cooper thinks he, or Cooper feels, not only that he thinks he can, I do believe that he, you know, on one level, he's like, well, if anyone can do it, I can do it. I also think deeper down psychologically, he feels like he has to. He can't resolve the various anxieties and hauntings the way human beings have to resolve them, the way maybe arguably Audrey did. He and Diane too. He feels like, oh no, I'm going to do something that no one else can do. And so he's deluded. It could be he's deluded because he just simply can't face the reality of who he is. Or he's deluded and that he thinks he truly believes that it's possible, I guess. And we talked about this before, you know, from part 16, especially through to the very end of part 17. It's such an amplified, exaggerated fantasy. I mean, it's just, what's really happening there? I don't know. I think we can make some good guesses to what really happens in part 16 and part 18. But we are seeing what Cooper wants to happen, is telling us that happened. And so it's all very unreliable.
Yeah, I like the idea that he's bent, but he's bent towards kindness, which I would argue is up in the air throughout the return. Is he going to bend towards darkness or kindness? I think is what's ultimately at stake there. And the way that you describe that, this delusion of his, hey, I think I'm the only one that can do it. You know, I would say you could put that in the mind of a school shooter, and they may think that that's a proper justification, but it's like a mental illness almost. To think such a thing. Do you agree?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I'm not sure we'll ever have an answer to, but why does Cooper think he is, quote, the one and only, unquote? I mean, that's what Diane calls him, but that Diane who calls him that is of his own, you know, concoction. And so he's the one and only. And I guess he sees him as he thinks he's a superhero. You know, he really does think he is. You know, we watch superhero movies. We all love superhero. I do. I love superhero movies. I love to read. And but I don't fool myself into thinking I can be a superhero. I mean, it's a fantasy. It's just like mythology, you know, the mythology of the ancient Greeks. You know, we had these stories of these superhuman beings, and they tell us interesting stories and lessons, and they kind of give us some perspective on our own humanity. And I like that aspect of them. I think Cooper doesn't see that necessarily. He really does believe that he can do something that no other human being can do. And so he thinks he can go back in time and save Laura. And getting back to the theme of thresholds, if you don't mind me jumping into part 17, I don't know if you had more in part 18. So in part 17, particularly from the point of Cooper standing in Truman's office and the lights go out, that to the point that Cooper is standing alone in the woods is again another series of threshold crossings and door. And in this case, we actually see some of the doors that Cooper has to cross. And doors is something we should sort of a subset of our topic of thresholds is something that's really interesting to talk about. And certainly some of the most interesting doors happen in part 17. So I mean, when Cooper's standing in the office, lights go dark, I would argue at that point he's reached a dead end. He doesn't quite know, you know, where, you know, what else. And we are seeing his superimposed face over the picture. So arguably we're seeing what the mind of Cooper is seeing. And so he, the mind of Cooper, decides, I can't take the story any further here in Truman's office. So I'm just going to dim the lights, literally like a, you know, a scene change on, I mean, there's a lot of references here now to stage plays. Literally, Cooper says, I'll see you at the curtain call to Diane. But the idea that the lights dim is when you're watching a play, they do that. They dim the lights. And then when the lights come up again, you're in a different scene. and that's what Cooper does. He's like the stage director. He dims the lights. And then they're suddenly, well, at first they're in a black void. And then they're in the Great Northern basement. And then there's this door there. And Cooper has seen this door before. This was the door that James Hurley encountered when he was ostensibly looking for the source of the humming noise that he heard in the Great Northern basement. I would argue that Cooper was watching all of that from afar, like his, we just didn't see his face at that moment. And he remembers that door, and he remembers, oh, okay, that door is a threshold. And if I can cross through that door, I can leave this world and make my way to my ultimate goal, which is 1989. But for Cooper, he has to do it, you know, procedurally. He can't just do it. He wants it to have legitimacy. And so he's like, okay, there's got to be a way to do it. He's sort of fooling himself into thinking it's really happening. Does that make any sense?
It does. Yeah. And I would just like to interject that first instruction that he's given is listen to the sound. And we know that a sound is this hum that's shared between multiple characters, and it's in the wall, it's underneath the floorboards of Ben Horn's office. They're looking for it. I believe we hear it in the scene where James first goes down to check that door. And so that idea was already kind of prevalent within The Return over several episodes of there, listen to the sound. There's this hum that is the source that you need to go to make something happen. And, you know, it's very creative what he does there, essentially. You know, he makes his own curtain fall happen and resets the scene. And so I think it's very much valid what you just went through there, that being a door and a portal of transformation that gives him some autonomy within the dream that he's watching, makes it vivid.
Yeah, he wants it to you know, make sense, even though so far much of it has, yeah, and so do we. And so maybe we're trying too hard to make it make sense. But I mean, if we think about it in terms of Cooper's mind, here's this door that he could not see behind. In fact, it's interesting when James is in the basement, he turns to look at the door, but he never approaches it. The scene cuts away. And so we don't know if James tried to open the door. We don't know if the door is locked or not. And so if we are Cooper in that moment, seeing what James is seeing, Cooper doesn't know either, but he remembers that door and he's like, okay, So it's interesting to me about the key. So it's interesting, really interesting to me about the key is that the key, this may sound like a real stretch, you know where I'm going to go because I've told you this already, but Cooper is haunted by doors, and there are doors that appear throughout The Return, I think, that Cooper has seen and watched over, you know, this 16 hours before part 17, and he's seen all these interesting doors. There's a door that Becky Burnett shoots her, you know, she approaches a door and she can't get through it, so she fires a gun into this door. There's this door that we see, it's the farmer's door that's sort of cocked half open, and there's this ominous push of the camera toward this threshold, implying something bad happened behind that door. There's another door and I'm forgetting it. There's the red door. Thank you. They make specific comment about the red door, and it's important that there's only one red door apparently in Lancelot Court. That door is red, and that is the exclusive door. That's the door that allows Cooper to find his way home. And so there's these doors that, you know, Cooper keeps seeing as he's watching the story unfold. There is a door that is probably forgotten by most people that's very interesting to me, and it's part one of all places. It's the door, it's Ruth Davenport's door, and Marjorie Greene is walking Armstrong, her little dog, through the hallway, and they smell an odd odor from behind the door, and you know, she's alarmed, and she calls the police, and the police come, and the door's locked, and the police talk about it for a while. Well, how are we going to get in? You know, we'll have to call a locksmith. And then they say, well, let's see if we can find the superintendent, and he can help us get in. And they go and they meet Hank, and, you know, there's all of these sort of, you know, tangent, you know, and you know, all these little weird happenings. And then Marjorie Greene goes, well, how am I gonna, I've got to water her plants, I've got her key. And she's had the key all along. Exactly, all she had to do was remember it. I have the key and I can open the door. And they do. It's this problem is solved. It's solved by remembering you have a key. And I think maybe it's a stretch, but for me it makes some sense that Cooper's like, you know, I have a key. And I don't know what's behind this door. So I remembered I have this key and I'm going to use it. Obviously it opens this door. He remembers to ask Frank Truman for it. And it's simplifying things. It's like, okay, there's a locked door and there's a key. Clearly they go together. And so, and the key we've talked about, you know, when we talked about magic objects in another podcast long ago, the key itself is, you know, is suspect. It has a phrase on it that shouldn't be there. Clean place, reasonably priced, which is in a way a manifestation of Cooper's mind. That's something he said. It was never on the key. And so he just remembers he has the key and he opens that door. Voila, they go through and he turns and says, I'm going through this door. Don't try to follow me. and he has to, you know, go on alone at this point. He can't afford to have Cole and Diane come with him because they could interfere. You know, he's gotta think this through and make sure each step along the way makes some logical sense in his mind. And so he does it by himself at that point.
Before we move away from the door that they walk through, it takes us to the dark motel, you know, Mr. C and Cooper have two different entrances that they enter that space. And I know you have some thoughts about this.
Yes, that's a critical door that I deliberately left out because I wanted to talk about it here. And there is another interesting situation with a locked door that I forgot, which is actually takes place right around what you're talking about. There is a moment where Mr. C is at the threshold of Philip Jeffries' room at the motel, room number 8, but the door is locked. And then suddenly this figure appears, the bosomy woman, with a key. And she says, I'll open it for you, and opens the door. So we've seen this happen before. But yes, one of the most interesting doors, it may not seem like it, but it really is this door that Mr. C passes through from the Dutchman's into the courtyard of the motel. Philip Gerard and Cooper also pass through a door into the same courtyard, but, and I've looked at this extremely closely, they are different doors. The one that Mr. C passes through appears to be a wooden door with some, you know, recessed panels with some bevel, you know, around inset into the door. So it is a wooden door. The door that Gerard and Cooper pass through is a metal door. And I think we can say that with some certainty because the sound effects subtitle indicates metal door opening or clanging when they open that door. And so it's a different door. And I looked really closely at that door. You can only see the outside of the door. They pass through it and they close it. So you can see the door closing. And it looked familiar to me. I thought, that door, I've seen that door before. And it's hard to tell because there's shadows and it happens really quick. So I'm doing it frame by frame and I'm looking at it and I'm like, wait a minute, I think I've seen that door before. Well, I'm pretty sure we have seen that door before. And we saw that door in Nato's room in part 3, when there was a pounding force that audible behind it, there was something banging on this metal door, and the scene cuts to the door and you see it, and the door has a couple of features to it that are the same features that are in the door that Gerard and Cooper pass through. The most obvious one are these two parallel metal bars that slide out from the middle to the frame to lock the door. There's actually a name for that that device. I think it's called a police crossbar lock or something like that. I have it written down somewhere, but let's not worry about it. Anyway, there is a name for that particular kind of lock where the and then there's a where the door handle is. There's a metal panel where the door handle is attached. Those features are there on the door that Gerard and Cooper pass through. And they are the same features that we see on this metal door that's being pounded against in Nato's room. The first important fact is it's a different door. It's not the door that Mr. C passed through. The second most important fact, if it's the same door, it's not deformed by the pounding. It looks whole, but it's still got those other locking features in it. You know, what does that mean? It probably doesn't mean much of anything, except maybe Cooper remembered that door. He was, his attention was drawn specifically, he focused on it when he was in part three, and he just repurposes that door. That is the door that he will use as his threshold to cross from the realm of the Dutchman's and into wherever Philip Jeffries exists. And so I know this is a long and kind of crazy and somewhat obscure analysis here, but Cooper remembered that door, and he probably was curious as to what was behind it. We all were. And here Cooper essentially solves that problem. You know, it was the Dutchman's, and I can walk through that door and find Philip Jeffries.
The scene just prior to Mr. C walking out into that courtyard, there's a woodsman there who has to like do some old school operator mechanics and plug this into that and almost like hack the system so that when he walks out that door, he'll be in the right place in time. Whereas Cooper, who's guided by, you know, this magician or whatever that lets him walk between worlds, goes straight from the source. I would argue that Cooper's door is the actual natural passageway between those spaces, as opposed to this hack, you know, situation that's going on with Mr. C. And that idea of where are they walking out from physically as they walk into that motel. Now, those of us who've been to the Mount Si Motel know that that faces a street right there. So there's not other rooms that face that. But I think in the world of the Dutchman, the Black Lodge, and wherever Cooper's coming from, we could be walking out of other motel rooms in that space into a centralized courtyard.
Yeah, I think there's all different. Well, I think we have to separate the world that Mr. C went into, which is, if you want to take it somewhat literally, and I kind of like to, is that he did go to this supernatural realm called the Dutchman's, and they guided him through because they've entrapped Philip Jeffries in a jail cell. That's why it's locked, so he needs to get access deeper into the prison that is the Dutchman's, and he goes through. At one point, he goes through that door and through the courtyard. That is somewhat different. More than somewhat, what Cooper is imagining when he opens the door from the Great Northern basement and into this dark realm where he meets Philip Gerard, that again, this is all concocted by Cooper. And so he just steers it the way, again, he wants to have some legitimacy to what he is doing. He wants to go through the checkpoints so that he is validating what is happening. So he goes to what he imagines is a Dutchman's like place and has someone guide him through it to Philip Jeffries. But he's making that up as he goes along.
I guess my point in making the distinction is that it feels like it's a natural force that's happening there. It's just how his imagination is supposed to naturally work in a state of vivid dreaming, as opposed to the other way, which is much more of a hack. It's this kind of negative virus in your brain that has to hack its way into manipulating the reality. But they do share an experience of going to this machine that calls itself Philip Jeffries that seems to be in control of memory. So this idea that this negative force has kind of gerrymandered your ability to manufacture your own reality through your memories, and they've kind of, you know, manipulated it and bastardized, and indeed maybe even put lies in the middle of that. It's all fake news stuff, right? Total propaganda. And so Cooper coming back in to reclaim that corrupted force, but then to, quote, use it for good, because I'm going to manipulate time. I'm manipulating the reality of my perception of what happens. I feel like that's all happening right there. We're seeing that whole drama play out over this war for controlling my own memories.
I think you're absolutely right when it comes to memories. I mean, to me, it's memory is a key thing here. It's a doorway. Memory is a door, is a threshold. And so what happens is, you know, Cooper goes and he encounters Jeffries. His encounter with Jeffries is much different than Mr. C's. I would, again, argue that Cooper's imagining this encounter with Jeffries. Now, again, it's Twin Peaks, and I understand the idea that Jeffries could be a spirit that can be communicating inside Cooper's mind, and it could be an autonomous being of some sort that Cooper is literally speaking with. You know, there's an entity called Philip Jeffries that he comes into contact with on some mental plane. So I definitely see that possibility. But what's interesting to me is that he's reached yet another point that he needs to cross over, and he needs to cross over into 1989. But, you know, when you look at what happens there with Jeffries, again, it all seems so designed for Cooper. So Jeffries sort of validates what Cooper's going to do. He says, don't worry, I'll find it for you. And Cole's going to remember the official version. So don't worry, this is all legitimate. You're going to do what you need to do. And then Jeffries gets a little crazy, because he is. He says some weird things that don't match. We talked about that in our Jeffries episode. But the last thing, or one of the last things, I can't remember if it is the last thing that Jeffries says, but it's very near the end. He says, Cooper, remember. And to me, what he's saying is the only way you can go back in time is to remember it. You can't literally go back in time. But if you just remember it, then you can go back in time. We all can go back in time if we think about something that happened in the past. So that's, in a way, that's time travel. And for me, that's what essentially what Jeffries, or Cooper, imaginative Jeffries, Cooper's subconscious Jeffries, is saying, okay, now you need to go back to 1989, remember it. And it's interesting to me, as I've studied this, Cooper closes his eyes at this point. He's standing there with Gerard, and he closes his eyes as if he's remembering. And then the camera moves in on Cooper. And so the implication is he's literally going back in time. But he closed his eyes. And to me, I read it very comfortably as Cooper saying, okay, let me remember what do I know of Laura Palmer? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we go with Cooper's mind into what he sees as the past, and he's there. And he sees Laura. And again, the things that he sees happening are things that he would have remembered from the report, you know, from the pilot. They talk about exactly what happened. We know, everybody knows that Laura was with James and they got on the motorcycle and she jumped off and ran into the woods. Cooper knows this. So he's like, well, that's where she's alone. I can get to her and I can intercept her at that point. And so that's where he goes to do that. And he remembers it.
I feel like he knows it so well because, you know, my theory that Firewalk With Me is a sequel, not a prequel. So this idea of he's gone through that case file over and over and over again till it feels like a memory. It feels like it really happened and he was really there. And so he knows all the mechanics of this and where to manipulate it in just the right way to tweak it so that a different outcome occurs, but it's still an outcome of the imagination, right?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I don't think that he, you know, here's where, again, it gets a little crazy. Like it hasn't been up until this point.
What are you
right?
talking about?
And now it gets crazy. If we take it somewhat at surface face value, Cooper has contacted Laura Palmer before. Their minds have overlapped before. And so despite all my argument and theory building, that all of this is Cooper's imagination, I would certainly accept and am leaning toward, sympathetic toward the idea that despite it being his imagination, when he reaches Laura Palmer, he is reaching Laura Palmer. That they are literally they're connecting, because he has done it before. He has connected with Laura before through his mind, and this is essentially through his mind. And so when she answers him, it's not just his imaginative Laura, it is Laura. And she takes his hand, and they walk, you know, into the woods. I think at this point, though, that Laura realizes this is not my destiny. I have something more important to deal with, whether it's subconscious, she has to go to the train car. She has to go through whatever gauntlet she's going to go through to be saved. She saves herself. I mean, that's critical. Nobody saves Laura but Laura. And so, you know, I know a lot of people are worried and concerned about how this alters Laura's story. I was too, but I don't feel that way anymore. I feel that Laura Palmer still controls her destiny. And that's why she screams and leaves Cooper. It's an agonizing scream, but it's still, you know, I think it means that it's impossible. What Cooper's trying to do is impossible, and Laura knows it's impossible. She will not go with him. And so he's left alone in the woods.
And I feel like that trauma that's related to that trauma doesn't sit still. Trauma goes somewhere, you know, and that idea of, you know, Laura controlling her own death. Well, that's the ending of The Last Temptation of Christ too. He goes ahead with the crucifixion because that's what he was there to do. That was a portal or a doorway or a threshold that he had to cross as a choice, not as a victim, right? There's a difference between someone who's not a victim.
Exactly.
And takes that on themselves.
Right.
It's the most heroic thing. I mean, that's the sacrifice of the soldier, right? That's
right.
The sacrifice of the first responder.
And that's a critical element of Twin Peaks that cannot be erased. And I don't think Lynch wants to erase it. I think, you know, when we see Cooper try to lead Laura away, Cooper just does not get it. And Laura may not understand it, but she knows it's the wrong choice to go with Cooper. And so I really believe that. I believe she makes the choice there to not continue. And you could argue that the agonizing scream is one, she's going to go through agony. I mean, she's choosing a terrible thing to have happen to her, but she knows she has to do that. You know, this gets tricky here because, you know, when do we assign Laura's acknowledgement of her goodness? I don't think it happens until she gets to the train car. So I want to be careful here of simplifying it too much. I think simply Laura does not belong with Cooper's shifted reality. And I like to believe that she is the one who chooses to remain in that original one.
I really love that reading. And I think it also gives some autonomy to Cooper as well, because what if Cooper is the engine through which this evil force, this evil extreme negative force, is finally and ultimately dissipated, removed from its ability to incorporate and attack other people. And I like the idea that this is what it takes, going through all of these portals and still maintaining the best of what's inside you, that incorruptible, you know, seed. And you and I both have kind of said that it's Laura Palmer's sacrifice. That's the golden seed at the heart of all Twin Peaks. It's incorruptible. It can't be removed. That idea that Laura is the one, to me, that's what that means.
Yeah, I think Laura is the one has a lot of meaning. Yes, she is in some ways a Christ figure. She is a savior. She is going to be the one who may eventually be in the darkness that remains and complete the circle, which is what the Log Lady tells us. So she is that figure. I'm not sure that Cooper, he may get it at a certain point, but he forgets it. He seems confused in the woods at the end. And then, you know, if we don't think of there being an ending of 17 and a beginning of 18. If we just continue with what we know of Cooper as he stands there in the woods, granted the credits roll when we go into part 18, but forget all that. We just literally were to watch it as it happened. Cooper is standing in the woods after she disappears, and there is, you have to look very, very closely. He turns his head slightly to the left, and his face is lit up with red. There's a red light that appears on Cooper's face while he's in the woods. And then, snap, he's back in the red room. And so as soon as Laura disappears, Cooper stands, for a moment in confusion, and then he's back in the red room. So my argument would be that he took it to the final point. He can't go any further than trying to lead Laura through the woods. Again, I don't know where he thought he was taking her. He was going into the woods. So maybe it was Jack Rabbit's Palace. Maybe it was Glastonbury Grove. Maybe I read somewhere recently, maybe he was going to take her home to Las Vegas with Janie E. I mean, that's a weird thing to think about. I'm not sure I buy it, but it's interesting. Because, Cooper, part of Cooper thinks of that as home. And so, but she disappears and he's back in the red room. And I think when he's back in the red room, all of that fantasy that he was telling himself that he was going to save her, it just crashes in, it implodes, and he's there back in the red room. You would hope at this point you'd be like, oh, okay, I really fooled myself. I deluded myself. But it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems as soon as he gets out, he's going to try it again, only this time, we're seeing it from a different perspective.
Well, and that's when he goes off and he can actually move through the curtain. Isn't that right? Isn't that the Red Room experience?
Yes. Yes. And,
again, so something's happened. Too far off.
Something's happened
that,
for sure.
In that border crossing there, that's given him powers that he didn't have before, or capability that he didn't have before.
Yeah, I think that there is at least, you're right, there is at least some sort of psychological restoration or rebalancing that occurs. And of course, we see it represented with the burning body of Mr. C in the Red Room. That Mr. C has been returned to the Red Room, and then he's been, quote unquote, destroyed. All of that is symbolic, I think, of Cooper having at least reunited with the darker half and suppressed it perhaps to the point where it doesn't dominate him. And so once that rehabilitation has occurred, it's only then that Cooper is able to leave this literal supernatural realm or psychological realm that he's been stuck in. He can only move forward and cross that threshold of the curtains after he has come to some sort of psychological terms with himself.
Well, here's where I think he gets that bonus. So there's a door that happens in between that, and that's where Dougie Jones, the Tulpa, that holds all of Cooper's love for his family, all of his sentimentality, all of the things that made him lovable both as Cooper and as Dougie Jones, comes home to his simulated family. And through a door, he knocks on the door, he's led inside, the door shuts with him in it, and it's a scene of domestic tranquility. And so I feel like that is a shedding of, that's where we actually see the shedding of who we know and love as Dale Cooper. It's deposited there and held in kind of a nice little sacred place that can't be touched going further. And that gives him the ability to manipulate the Red Room in a way that he couldn't before.
I agree with you. I think, it's hard to read of course, nothing can be read exactly into it. But yes, I think that's the happy ending. I do believe that's Cooper's happy ending. And I think that that it could not happen until that rehabilitation occurred. So in a way, two Coopers come out again, right? We have a Cooper, which is Dougie, but I mean, it's not really, we don't know exactly, we don't have enough to know what Dougie that is. It's not the original Dougie Jones who was just kind of an oaf and, he was he was cheating in his job. He was skimming, you know, or he was falsifying reports and stuff like that. So that's not the Dougie that comes back. But is it the Dougie that has just been sort of just sort of drifting in this blissful existence? I'm not sure. I think it might be a Dougie with some autonomy to him. Would agree with you that it is a version of Cooper. Maybe it's his fantasy version, but he gets this life, and then this other Cooper, who's still stuck in the programming, comes out, and he's an agent, and he's got to go finish this job,
right,
which he doesn't really understand.
John, where do you think, when the hole gets punched by Freddy with the green glove in 17 and through the floor, where do you think Bob goes when he gets punched through the floor?
Well, when he breaks into pieces and he sort of dissipates.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, again, we have to think of Bob in two different ways. We have to think of him as a metaphor, as the evil that men do. Mm-hmm. And we have to think of him as this, inhabiting demon that it can, you know, do really bad things.
Yeah, so, particle wave.
So right,
particle wave.
So, I think the same thing happens in part 17 that happened in, I think it's part 16 of the original, episode 16 of the original series, when Leland is in the cell. He's locked up in the sheriff's station, and Bob leaves Leland. Bob leaves, he departs from Leland. Leland dies. Arguably, Bob killed Leland by forcing him to smash his head against the door. And then Bob leaves and is out in the world looking again for either someone else to possess, or he, again, is just the evil that men do. For Cooper, metaphorically, and again, everything that's going on in Truman's office in part 17 is just, I mean, you just can't take any of it literally. So Bob is purged from Cooper at that point. So there is no Bob in Cooper anymore. Whether or not this is Cooper saying, I'm no longer susceptible to these evil tendencies, or I'm not going to hide behind the mask of Bob, or whether I'm just aware of it. Exactly. I don't think Bob is killed, again, because we're reducing Bob to this entity that can be killed. I don't think Bob is, you know, that. Yeah. So, you know, Bob is evil. He's out there in the world. And so, he's just back out there in the world. And not that he wasn't already out there in the world. I mean, he's out there, and this is a dark, dark age, as Janie E tells us. And so Bob is part of that dark age. Bob cannot really be stopped until Laura, if you think about it, the Hindu mythology, Laura screams and restarts the cycle of ages, ends a dark age and brings about a golden age. And so it will take hundreds, thousands of years for evil to creep back in again. Again, this is Hindu philosophy. And it's a long, long answer to your question, is that for Cooper's psychological sake, Bob is no longer a factor. For our quote unquote literal reading of it, Bob has just fled the scene and has gone back out into the world. No longer messing around.
Reminds me of Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, strike me down now and I will become more powerful than you could possibly imagine. You know, become so evil and pervasive and deceptive that you won't even know I'm there.
You know, but in some ways it's the opposite, because I think Bob becomes more powerful when he's able to inhabit someone. He feeds off of the pain that they cause and the pain that they're feeling. And so when he is dissipated, he becomes weakened. And this gets, again, I get real uncomfortable in getting to try to nail it down into some literalness. I think Bob can blossom in other people, and the worse things that they do, the more powerful Bob, quote unquote Bob, becomes in them. So,
John, do you think that, you know, just this is all theoretical, obviously, but in that part 16 that you were talking about where Bob finally leaves Leland, mm-hmm. and if we could see the interior landscape of what was happening inside of Leland Palmer, would we see Woodsman anywhere near a Bob bubble?
You know, I don't.
Is it something totally concocted by Cooper's mind?
I don't think we would see Woodsman in the Leland situation. I think, Leland, look, Leland is not, Leland's a bad guy. There's no doubt about it. Leland is aware of what he's done. He is culpable, and Mark Frost acknowledges that Leland shares responsibility for the bad things that happened. But, if there is any, Cooper comforts Leland and tries to guide him to a better place. And so there's an element of forgiveness going on there. Whether or not you could truly forgive the kinds of things that Leland did, there at least is this implication that Leland is going to a better place. We see Leland in the last episode of season two where he sees Cooper and he says, "I did not kill anybody." The implication there is that there was a good Leland and a bad Leland, I suppose. And then of course the Leland Palmer we see sitting in the chair, that Cooper encounters in part two and part 18. And he says, "Find Laura." This is a Leland who is probably eternally atoning for his sins. But is no longer "quote unquote" an evil Leland, if that makes any sense. And this is a tricky area to step into. And I know people out there might be like, "Whoa, what are you saying here?" I think Leland's a complicated character. I think he's a tragic character, and I think that tragedy comes through in the little bits of Leland we see in The Return, that he is still paying for and aware of his role in what he did, but he is no longer capable of doing those things.
I know Ray Wise jokes a lot about not being in Twin Peaks or Return at all, but that one line of dialogue told a whole story, didn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it gets to the idea that, he doesn't say save Laura. He says find Laura. So the implication, and Laura Palmer has said to Cooper already, "I'm dead, yet I live." And so you get those two things together. First, Laura says, or whatever Laura is, she's something else at this point. She says, I'm dead, yet I live. And then she disappears. And then Cooper sees Leland, who says, "Find Laura." And so you just sort of, on a very simple level, Laura's alive. She disappeared. You need to find her. And right. That's what Cooper.
And when you find her, she disappears again, and you need to find her again. And it's like this, this never-ending cycle of torture almost. But I like the idea that the last thing Laura Palmer whispers to him is, "Let me go. just let me go. Just let it go."
Well, we don't know what
what it is. So that's where we read it into ourselves, which is totally fine. That's just how I like to read it. So
yeah.
My gosh, I feel like we could go on this topic for another 4 hours. It's already been an hour and 45 minutes. Can you believe that?
Wow. So I wonder if
I'd say let's try and find some type of a stopping place.
Yeah, I think we should definitely stop. Yeah. We've gone on and on. This was a very simple topic. We were just going to talk about thresholds. And yet at the same time, the idea of thresholds implies opening from one world into another. And so we've done that. Perhaps we've done it too much. We've opened a lot of doors here, and we've gone down a lot of hallways, a lot of avenues, explored different tangents of The Return by opening these doors. And I think in some respects that's what you're seeing in it, in The Return, is you've got doors that are closed, doors that are open, doors that Cooper can't get through, doors that Cooper wants to get through. And all of these represent the struggle in his psychology to try to map his way to some sort of peace. And I'm not sure he succeeds, but he is nevertheless on this journey.
I think it's a great way to wrap it up. And I really do think that we could go on for 4 or 5 hours talking about this topic, because we didn't even make it back past 17. We didn't talk about the fork and the socket or none of that stuff, or NATO and the purple room. And we talked a little bit about it, but my God, I mean, there's a door that goes up to the top of the purple power station too. There's so many doors in Twin Peaks. And if you think about the journey that actually happens from the part one all the way through part 18, it's real easy to dismiss Twin Peaks the Return as nonsense, you know, if you didn't like it the first time for whatever reason. But when you really start to go back and dissect the journey that happens from part one to part 18, it may be the most dense and complex television series that I can even think of.
Exactly. And if two other people came along who wanted to talk about doors and thresholds, they might, you know, have a conversation that is completely different than the one that we just had. Completely different conclusions, different observations, and that is the beauty of it.
It really is. It really is. Well, John, we're going to leave it here for now. We may, you know, come back and take up this topic at some point, and I'm sure it'll become a sub-theme for our future episodes. But I really do appreciate getting together with you and talking Twin Peaks. It really matters to me.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. It's always fun. Always fun.
All right, friends. Well, till next time, keep watching and keep listening. Through the cities of the plague.
still yearning. Got to get you out of my miserable brain. All my loyal and my much loved companions, they approve of me and share my. Thank you.